Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships for transfers available at carthage.edu/admissions/transfer. Support also comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2018, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. JackandDrea.com. And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. On today's morning show, we're going to be talking about a wonderful book about football that football fans are sure to love. But I hasten to add that this is a book that I think could be very compelling, even for someone who is not a football fan at all. Because at its heart, this book is not so much about football as it is about three gifted and complicated human beings who rose to the upper echelons of the game. Three of the most successful coaches in NFL history who each had to battle past adversity. I'm talking about Joe Gibbs of the Washington Redskins, Bill Parcells of the New York Giants, and Bill Walsh of the San Francisco 49ers. And their collective story is told in the book called Guts and Genius, the story of three unlikely coaches who came to dominate the NFL in the 1980s, published by Grand Central Press. I asked the author, Bob Glauber, to defend a very strong statement he made in the book's introduction, namely that the 1980s was the single greatest decade in NFL history. I asked him how that was true.
First of all, you know, the league had matured at that point from a time when, you know, in the 1950s, black and white TV, grainy picture, broadcasts of football, some of the great showdowns, the Baltimore Colts Giants game, the championship game, the famous game there, which kind of rocketed it into popularity. Then the 60s came along and you had Vince Lombardi kind of dominate that era with his great Green Bay Packers teams. Then you had the 70s, which is a very intriguing decade. You had, you know, the rise of the Dallas Cowboys, the Pittsburgh Steelers, and the Miami Dolphins, and the Raiders, with the Raiders sprinkled in there. And the football was great. The rivalries were great. But I think along came the 80s, and it was kind of a natural evolution to where the game technically got much better. The athletes certainly got better. And, you know, the class of 1983 draft was the greatest of all time with a bunch of quarterbacks and so many other great players, Eric Dickerson, Darryl Green, the great Redskins cornerback. I mean, it was really a transcendent draft. And I think you put that together with the great coaching abilities of three unlikely coaches. And, you know, people look back and say, well, how could you call these guys unlikely? Well, if you look back, of course they're not unlikely. They're in the Hall of Fame. But in 1979, the year Bill Walsh started, if someone had told you, well, the next decade is going to be defined by these three coaches, and it's Bill Walsh, Joe Gibbs, and Bill Parcells, your natural reaction would be, who are you talking about? Because they were not known. I mean, Bill Walsh was a college coach who had been passed over with the Bengals. Joe Gibbs was an offensive coordinator with San Diego who is not known at all. Jack Kent Cook, who ended up hiring Joe Gibbs, had not heard of Joe Gibbs until the hiring process began. And Bill Parcells was a lightly known defensive coach with the Giants who had bounced around in colleges. So once they kind of got their hands on their teams and were able to shape things, there was remarkable football. And it was an era that you could keep your players in practice for as long as you wanted and practice them as hard as you wanted. And you can't do that now. The rivalries that were created were magnificent. A lot between those three coaches, and you had teams that you knew who those teams were. This was before free agency, so you could keep good teams together, and that's what they did. And after that decade of the 80s came the 90s when free agency began to, it didn't pick apart the NFL, but it evened things out. And there were no great, the rivalries kind of decreased a little bit. And today, if you ask a football fan, what are the greatest rivalries in today's game? And I've done this a number of times. Well, they'll say, okay, well, Pittsburgh-Baltimore. And then there's silence. Because just didn't have that, you know, Giants, Redskins of the 80s. You knew it. Giants, Cowboys, Redskins, Eagles, Giants, 49ers, Walsh against Parcells. They're just, it was just a very compelling athletic product, and it was a compelling intellectual product because of what was going on in the minds of these three coaches who collectively dominated that decade in a way we've never quite seen before.
I think it's really interesting that you decided to take on what I think had to be a rather complex challenge for you as the author to tell three stories in conjunction with each other. Maybe in some ways it made it simpler, but because I suppose in some ways it would be impossible to tell any one of these stories in complete isolation of these other two coaches. And yet I came away from your book really impressed that you were able to weave together these three complicated storylines. I wonder, as you went into actually crafting this book, did that challenge seem like a stiffer challenge than you anticipated, or did this book, at least in that respect, kind of write itself? Was it really the most natural way to tell this particular story?
Oh, it was a challenge, my friend. It was a big challenge, and I'll take you back to a lunch I had with the editor and publisher who at Grand Central, who's become a good friend of mine, Sean Desmond. And Sean is the one I pitched these several ideas to in, I believe it was October of 2016. And he really loved that one about the 80s. And you know, I gave him the stats about Gibbs, Parcells, and Walsh winning 8 Super Bowls combined over. And Walsh, I included George Seifert's Super Bowl because it was Walsh's team. But, they, you know, 8 Super Bowls over an 11-year period, which was pretty remarkable. So he said, oh, I love that one. Let's talk about that. But we talked about it some more, and he said, I think this one can really work. And we agreed on it, and we had lunch, and I go, all right, Sean, I'm really pumped up because I know this era. I covered this era. I know all the coaches. Knew Walsh, talked to him, you know, on a handful of occasions, not many times, but enough. And I said, all right, here's my problem. How the hell am I going to arrange this thing? You know, I'm telling three stories simultaneously, and he looked at me and said, yeah, okay. Let me think about that. He said, and he told me there's a concept in the book writing industry called braiding and weaving. You know, you braid hair, and you have to kind of braid. You have to fit it together, and it makes sense. And it was definitely a concern. And my daughter Emily, I ran that past her, and she said, you know, Dad, in a lot of ways, like in songs, in themes, in plays, there are three simultaneous storylines going on. And in a great aria or a great, you know, Broadway musical song, you often have three kind of different songs going on within that one song. And it all fits together at the end. And I'm like, okay, I think I get that. And so what I did was basically took it by year and kind of early era of each and as the eras went on. So, for instance, Walsh in the beginning of the book was Walsh was 79 to 81. And that kind of was a natural thing. Actually, it was 79-80. So when he, you know, the formative years of the 49ers, they were 2-14 and then 6-10. And he had tremendous struggles during that time, both emotionally and physically with his team. Then I went to Gibbs, so because Gibbs was hired in 81, did him from 81 to 82 when he won the Super Bowl. Then Parcells was hired in 83 as the Giants head coach. And then it went from there. You know, it went back to Walsh in 84. He won the Super Bowl that year. Then back to Parcells 85, 86, and he goes for his Super Bowl. And then back to Gibbs and then Walsh. So it really did kind of have a natural flow to it once I got going. And I was able to kind of go back when I needed to within certain segments. If I needed to go back in history or in time about their lives or perhaps games that they played that were important, I just had the flexibility to do that. And I've been writing for, as you said, a long, long time. And it's true. I have been writing a long time. This was so liberating I said to friends, it's so journalistically liberating, man, because I'm used to writing with deadlines of tomorrow or today. And it was great to just be able to breathe and let it go and come back to it and, you know, work on it some more. And it was a lot of fun and very, very fulfilling.
Hmm. Before we dig into a few more specifics from your fantastic book, I would like to have you talk about who you spoke to and who was especially valuable for you as author in terms of trying to uncover the sort of the inner workings of how these three marvelous coaches accomplished what they did. And I guess I should preface that by saying that you interacted with all three of these coaches on a very regular basis during the years that we are talking about. So you obviously went into this project knowing an awful lot about them and their successes and the key to their successes. That being said, what was there left to explore, and who was most valuable to you in exploring sort of deeper layers of their story?
There were so many people to talk to about the coaches. Now, obviously, the first two people that come to mind are Gibbs and Parcells, because they're living and they're, I've known them. And I've known Parcells very well over the years. From the time I started covering football in 1985 as a beat writer for the Gannett newspapers in Westchester County, New York. And then I got to know Gibbs during that time because they played the Giants quite frequently. But I was not a beat writer for the Redskins, so Gibbs didn't know me like Parcells knew me. But he had enough of a working knowledge of who I was to kind of open up as things went on. And I will tell you that getting in touch with Joe Gibbs for any period of time is really tough because that guy got a reputation of being hyper busy with the Redskins. He would sleep in the office three nights a week to get his game plans going. And he's now at NASCAR, and he doesn't sleep in his office, but he's got a fever pitch of a schedule. And NASCAR goes for about 9 months. And I literally had to wait 9 months at the beginning of the interview, from the beginning of the interview process, to get in touch with him. Once I did, it was fine, and he was great with it, and we just had to get that right time. Now, Walsh was obviously a potentially trickier subject, but I have found over the years, when I have to write about somebody who is unable to speak for whatever reason, you write about people, I find that pretty compelling. And because people, you know, have their recollections of him and or her, and it's just a freer way of talking about that person, and I did find that to be the case with Walsh. So, you know, Parcells, I visited with him up at his home in Saratoga over the summer last year, and he had me in. We spent 6 hours that day, and then, you know, countless phone calls after that, just to go over some stuff, and he was very, very generous with his time. Talking about Bill Parcells, I talked to many of his players, Lawrence Taylor, Phil Sims. Sims was particularly helpful on a number of levels because Bill Walsh actually scouted him, and that was pretty fascinating. Some of his players, Joe Morris, Carl Banks, Jim Burt, you know, the guys who he called my guys. When he was coaching the Giants, he needed to find, I got to find my guys, and that was a big turning point for him in 1984. And then, you know, talking to many of his coaches, Bill Belichick, you know, prominent among them. I have known some family members. You know, Scott Pioli of the Atlanta Falcons, he's the assistant general manager. I've known him a long time. And then Gibbs, you know, again, coaches, players, talked to all three. I talked to all the quarterbacks who succeeded with those coaches, and that was a must. So with Gibbs, now it's Theismann, Doug Williams, and Mark Rippon. With Parcells, it was Sims and Jeff Hostetler. And then with Walsh, of course, it was Joe Montana and Steve Young. And I found all of them to be fascinating. The one or two people I really got a lot from with Walsh, and that was the big challenge because I didn't have the kind of institutional knowledge of Bill Walsh that I had with Parcells and Gibbs, just because I've been around them so long. But actually, there are three people with Walsh, and the first was Dick Vermeil, and he was his good friend growing up in the coaching business. And Vermeil had a lot in common with Bill Walsh. He was terrific to talk to. And he said, have you talked to Mike White? I go, no, I haven't. He says, you need to talk to Mike White, because that was really his best friend. So Mike White had been an assistant coach for Bill Walsh. They knew each other as college coaches at Cal and at Stanford. And Mike White has known Bill Walsh, you know, since they were in their 20s. And he was amazing. He just had recollection of Bill Walsh at a level that I had never heard of. You know, from just his personality to his temperament to how he formed teams, but also to his sense of humor. One time, Bill Walsh was a big practical joker, and he, his wife, and Mike White and his wife went to a casino in Lake Tahoe one time, and they were just on vacation hanging out. And Don Rickles was the comedian, was the entertainment at that point. And Rickles got involved. Walsh went to Rickles and said, "Don, I'd like you to play a practical joke." And he gave him a book with blank pages. And the blank pages, the book was titled "What Mike White, Everything Mike White Knows About Football." So during his act, Rickles, you know, he does his thing, and he says, "Hey, I'd like to point out, you know, Bill Walsh is here, the great coach of the 49ers, and, you know, Bill's got a friend here, and, you know, he'd like to make a presentation." And he says, "Hey, this is a book. This is the story of Mike White, Everything I Know About Football." And then he shows the blank pages to the audience, and they crack up. And Mike White loved it. They would go bike riding, and Bill Walsh always took the better bike and left Mike with this, you know, tough bike they got to get up hills with, and, you know, and just an extremely funny man. And John Madden, you know, shared even more about Bill Walsh's sense of humor, and it was incredible. They once played a joke on Don Shula. Don wanted to get into the golf club of where Madden and Walsh had belonged to, and there was a process where you had to kind of meet with the members there and the committee. And he did that, and Don was fine, and he was going to get in. They met with his wife, but Walsh wanted to bust his chops a little bit, so he pulls Shula and Madden aside and said, "Don, we got a little problem. Everything's fine with Marianne, his wife. Everything is fine. They love her, and she's good. With you, it's maybe 50-50. Maybe it's 48-52. So they just need to see a little more personality. They think you're a little bit stiff. You know, they think you need to kind of show yourself. Who are you? You know, who?" So I think if you go back and you just go talk to people, just kind of, you know, interact with them a little bit, maybe they'll get a better feel for it. So Don does that. He goes back into the crowd, mingles with the members. Meanwhile, Walsh and Shula are just cracking up that they got him to do it. So, and then he comes back and he says, okay, Don, I think you're going to have a shot now." Of course he was going to get in. But the fact that Bill Walsh was able to pull that off with Don Shula was remarkable. And I think it showed his other side, the very playful side to him that I don't know that a lot of people know about.
Exactly. That's certainly not part of the main persona that he was so renowned for. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with award-winning sports writer Bob Glauber about his newest book, which is called Guts and Genius, the story of three unlikely coaches who came to dominate the NFL in the 1980s. We are talking about the magnificent careers of three exemplary NFL head coaches, Bill Walsh, Joe Gibbs, and Bill Parcells. And this book is a thorough examination of all three of these gentlemen and their careers. Bob Glauber, you choose to begin your book with three tales of woe for each of these coaches, which catch them at sort of the lowest ebb of their experiences as in the NFL early on in their coaching careers, each of them. Although it's probably to some extent obvious, I want to hear from you. What prompted you to begin the book in this way, not with stories of glory, but stories of real suffering and crushing disappointment experienced by all three of these men who would go on to become legends.
Yeah, it's a good question, and it relates to that issue we talked about before about braiding, about weaving the storylines. And again, at a lunch with Sean Desmond, the publisher and editor, that was his suggestion. He says, just think about stories short, you know, about where they struggled. And just a good way to kind of bring them all in and present the challenges that they faced. And I wrote it pretty quickly. And I told you about my daughter, Emily, and she was very much into it, and she read it over. And I was nervous, man. It's like, I don't know how to pull this thing together. And she just read it and took her time, and she just gave me a big hug. And it was like, Dad, you did it. And it was a great moment because it kind of underscored that, okay, I felt it was right, and it really did feel right. But I think the reason that it worked to me was that it did show a side of all three of those coaches when there was self-doubt, and a lot of self-doubt. Bill Walsh, I mean, it was the most crushing moment of his professional career occurred when Paul Brown passed him over to become the head coach of the Bengals in 1976. He was mortified. He thought he had it. He had worked tirelessly for Paul Brown, had come up with these great, unique concepts, many of which Brown was getting credit for and not Bill Walsh. And what happened was he had to get away. Once he was passed over, he immediately left. He left his wife and children in Cincinnati, and he flew out to Mike White's house. And we talked about him before. That's his best friend. Like, okay, who did Bill Walsh go to at his lowest moment? And it was Mike and Marilyn White. He just needed a refuge, and they lived in outside of San Francisco, and he just went holed up in their home for a couple of days, went in the basement, and just made some calls there and tried to figure out his next step. He just had to get away. And Mike White and Marilyn White had just great recollection of that time, and it was just so difficult for him. Joe Gibbs was, he was 0-5 in his first three seasons, five games as the Redskins coach. And he, during that losing streak, he goes up to this defensive tackle, a veteran who had been on the team for many years and one of their best players, and Gibbs is a little concerned about losing players like Dave Butts. He didn't want to have them check out emotionally, and he went up to him after a practice and said, "Hey, I just want you to hang in there. I really believe we can turn this thing around. I think we can." But deep down, Joe Gibbs wasn't sure. And he talks many times about becoming the first coach fired in NFL history without ever winning a single game. And he believed it. You know, Jack Ken Cook would come up to him in the office, and Joe would be scared. He says, I think I might be getting the hook right here. Because, Cook was a notoriously impatient owner and a very demanding owner. So he just didn't know. And then Bill Parcells was, at the end of the 83 season, he was going to be fired by the Giants. I mean, the decision had been made. George Young, the general manager, the co-owners Tim and Wellington Mara, both of whom were not speaking to one another. There was a very deep and long-standing family feud going on there. They had all decided that Bill couldn't. It was just above him. He was out of his depth. He couldn't handle it. 3-12-1. He had lost both his parents over a seven-month span. An assistant coach of his had died. Tremendous run of injuries, 25 players on injured reserve, and they just couldn't get it done. In fact, John Mara, the Giants' current owner, spoke of a story about the team. The team was looking to sell half of its share. Tim Mara was looking to sell half of his share, and Nick Bonacani, the former Dolphins linebacker, was among those interested. And Bonacani told the team, "Listen, I'm willing to buy it, but you got to get rid of that coach. You got to fire Parcells." And, it's like, whoa. So there are three moments of truth for all of those coaches that they had to face and face down. And obviously they did it. So I think it was just a little bit more of a compelling way to get into it rather than, get them at the height of their careers. Joe Gibbs is holding the Lombardi Trophy aloft, the coronation of a great coach. Well, we all know that. We've all seen that. We saw it three times with Gibbs, three times with Walsh, and twice with Parcells. And know, those are iconic moments that everybody sees. But to me, you know, the more compelling part of it is that how they rose from obscurity, and that's why they were unlikely. And the unlikeliness really manifested itself in the very beginnings and the challenges that they faced early on. And then the reason to me that Walsh worked well in going back to that time is because, you know, Paul Brown not only demoralized him, but that was the seed that was planted that caused Bill Walsh to want to help everyone along the way. Anyone he worked with, he wanted to help them desperately because he felt the pain of a coach who would not help him. And out of that moment, out of that time that he was passed over by Brown, you know, Brown unwittingly unleashed, you know, the greatest coaching tree in the history of sports, not only just the NFL, but sports, because what Bill Walsh did to create a lasting coaching tree that continues to blossom today, it came from that time. And that particular moment when Brown passed him over and Bill had to get away and be with his friend Mike White and his wife to just, you know, figure out the rest of the way.
I love that the book is titled Guts and Genius. And I think in talking about where the book opens with these tales of woe, that's certainly the guts part that they had to endure some incredible difficulties, some really enormous challenges, some which were, of course, even outside of the scope of their immediate control, and just had to weather those tough times. And of course, there is the matter of genius, which of course each of them also had as part of their makeup, and that's what we'll explore now. Let's start with Bill Walsh. And one of the things that's quite intriguing about this story of the man who would eventually become head coach of the 49ers through their greatest years is what a hard beginning he had. That is a hard childhood. And I wonder if you could say a word about how you think this was a significant factor in the man that he was to become and the coach that he was to become. And let's first begin by explaining to our listeners the ways in which his upbringing was not easy.
Yeah, and this was, I neglected to mention Craig Walsh, Bill's son, as a person who was important to speak to. He honestly might have been the most important person in the Bill Walsh section because he offered so much insight from Bill's time in Cincinnati to being told by Bill Walsh about that childhood. And that childhood was very difficult. His dad was a auto repair. He worked on auto bodies, and he would just repair cars. Now, it was a blue-collar living. Craig talked about drinking and did not treat his family very well. It was a different time, and it was kind of an accepted form of behavior that in today's world would not be tolerated at all. But back then it was kind of accepted and you moved along with it. But Bill was a very sensitive child and did not like the fact that they moved around quite a bit. They moved up and down the West Coast quite often, moved up to Oregon for a couple of years where the father had a business that failed. And then there were just times when Bill was a very lonely child because they had to move. He could never really fit in with the crowd. He used sports, he used football to kind of just fit in and find a niche, and that was really his salvation. There was one instance where Craig was telling me that Bill was about 11 or 12, and living in Los Angeles at the time with his family. He had a sister, and the family got him a pet duck. He just got him a duck where they would put him in the backyard, and he would come home every day and tend to the duck. He'd watch the duck grow. He'd feed it. He would just care for it. He just loved that duck. And one day, Bill came home, and he didn't see the duck. And Craig is telling me that Bill has told them this story, and so he didn't see the duck, and he's asking around, and he asks his mother, "Where's the duck?" He asks his father, "Where's the duck?" And they don't really say anything. And a few minutes later, he goes inside, and he smells something in the oven being cooked for dinner, and it was the duck. And when I heard that story from Craig, the hair on my neck was up. I just couldn't believe it. I literally wanted to cry because it was just so disturbing. I mean, that's a disturbing story to hear, and can only imagine what impact it had on Bill, young Bill Walsh. And Craig, even though Bill was such a young person at that time, Craig did say there was something in Bill that hardened at that moment, where he realized, he said, I can't count on these people, and they're just not going to help me, and I'm going to have to just figure this out on my own. And it was, you know, look, at that early age, you're not crystal, you're not intellectually mature enough to kind of know exactly what that means. It was more an emotional reaction that he's going to have to figure this out on his own, and whatever he does in life, you know, he's going to have to do it alone. And it was a very important. I just found that fascinating. And in the reporting of it, Craig and I had spoken probably 15 times, and maybe it was the 10th time that we spoke. And he was very, very helpful and just very open. And, you know, Mike White and Craig were very close, and talking to Mike was very important. And Mike says, you know, I got to put you in touch with Craig. He's great. And we got to get you two together. And gosh, that was an incredible light into Bill Walsh. And Craig was saying, he said, I don't know if I have not seen this story written, but I'll tell you, you probably can't use it. And he goes on to tell me that story about the duck, and I'm like, oh, my God.
Wow.
You know, as a journalist, I'm saying, wow. I'm saying to myself, Craig, no, this is a big story because it really kind of offers a window into who Bill Walsh was at an early age and ultimately who he became.
Right. He was, as you tell us in several different stories, an incredibly sensitive man, and for all of his outward confidence, which sometimes read as arrogance, he could also be just nearly paralyzed by self-incrimination. And you tell us a story in particular during I think it's his first season, where they the 49ers start out 3-0 but then lose 8 straight games, and you describe this scene on the plane where they are flying back home, and Bill Walsh is crying, and his assistant coaches are actually kind of standing around him trying to pretend like they're engaged in conversation, but what they're really trying to do is shield him so his players don't see this deeply vulnerable side of him. And what I want to ask you is, if you think that deep vulnerability of Bill Walsh, that inner kind of emotional fragility, was an important component in his success as a coach? And if so, how? Or was it just a facet of his personality that was not helpful, that he had to sort of keep at bay as much as he could so he could use the gifts and characteristics that really did matter in his coaching in order to succeed? Which of those choices do you think it is in terms of Bill Walsh?
Yeah, I think it was both, honestly. And the reason I say that is because I think his fragility and his and that's a good word for it, because he was a fragile personality. Vermeil knew that. The people closest to him knew that. And there were other stories along the way where he just had these moments of doubt. That one you talked about, where on the plane coming back from Miami, that was actually the second year he was he finished 6-10 that year. And he had lost to Don Shula. Now, you know, obviously he's busting chops with Don Shula many years later, but at that time, you know, Shula was still king of the NFL and still widely regarded as perhaps the greatest coach ever. And Bill Walsh, he wrote about that in his own book, The Score Takes Care of Itself. I was fascinated by that story and got some further insight into it from John McVay, his general manager, who was in that cluster of coaches and personnel people who surrounded Bill to make the team, you know, just shield the team from seeing that. But that, you know, and the fragility was, it did a couple of things. And that instance in particular, he cried and his shoulders were heaving. And he was just crying. And why? Because he felt he couldn't do it. He said, I'm done. I can't do this. It's too big for me. And all that, all that intense desire to be that great coach, you know, from Cincinnati, and that anger at being passed over by Paul Brown. You know, part of him was like, well, maybe he was right. Maybe Paul Brown kind of knew, and I can't do this. And it was just such a defining moment because out of it, he made it through, and there was just something that kind of happened inside his head and his heart that he said, okay, I've got to just get up. You know, he was a big boxing fan and had been a boxer as a kid. I got to just get up off the mat and fight, and I have to do it. And slowly but surely, he kept at it, and he kept believing in his system. And he says, look, I have to do this. And there was a great comeback win over the Saints at home that really keyed things that year. They ended up finishing 6-10, and then, you know, they went on to win the Super Bowl the next year. So that was important to him, but it was also important as far as empathy goes. You know, he had this fragility about him, so he knew that fragility existed in everybody. And I think it made him a more sensitive coach to his players' needs emotionally, psychologically. And he was always cognizant of that. It was a very holistic, and Steve Young used that word, very holistic approach to coaching players. It was not just do this, do these drills, get better, here's how we're going to win. It was, you know, he had to worry about how they were off the field, how they were with families, how they interacted with their teammates, how they dealt with an increasingly African-American locker room in the NFL at that time. He saw that the league was transforming from a league that was all white, you know, several decades earlier to, you know, mostly black players. So he used that fragility, I think, to kind of gain more empathy for other people, including his players and especially his players. So that's why I say it's both. That fragility helped him and hurt him. It hurt him in that he would become paralyzed. I mean, he wanted to resign as the head coach after the 1982 season, just a year after he'd won the Super Bowl. And again, those deep lows that Paul Brown was worried about, those deep lows were, you know, they would consume him. They ultimately did consume him because he burned out after 10 years, and he could have gone 10 more if he had a different temperament. But that's who he was, and he accepted it, and he had to live with it. But, you know, it limited it in some ways, but it also kind of opened up his ability to relate to people.
Right. And by the way, we should mention that's a sad fact that these three coaches all share in common, is that they all had to step away from the game. I think in your words, they all had to step away because the game had consumed them in various ways. Let's talk about Joe Gibbs, the great head coach of the Washington Redskins. And you map out for us his life, his career growing up in the South, son of a deputy sheriff, a talented quarterback. And one of the best stories you tell about him is in his days after graduation, when he is a graduate assistant for his coach at San Diego State, a great story that involves another legendary NFL coach in the making, one John Madden. You want to share this story with our listeners?
I love that story. Now, John Madden is telling me, you talk about great interviews that you have in your career, and I was legit nervous talking to John Madden because, I mean, I grew up listening to him. He was terrific. He's just the best sports color person in the history of broadcast journalism. Just a great career, charisma, you know, like you wouldn't believe. So, well, I knew he had a connection with Gibbs and Walsh, and I knew that he'd have a lot of stories to offer. So he talks about this time when he is the defensive coordinator for Don Coryell at San Diego State. And Coryell's the head coach, and Gibbs had played for him and was the graduate assistant. So they didn't really quite know what to do with Gibbs, so they put him on Madden's staff as the defensive assistant. And Madden explained that when John would work with the defensive linemen, Joe would work with the linebackers, and then vice versa. So in the spring of their first year together, they became very good friends. They would play racquetball together, play handball. Those competitions were great. They really kind of got to know each other and liked each other very much. So one day they had a game where alumni from San Diego State were to play the regular team. So Madden coached the regular team, you know, the current team at San Diego State. and Gibbs coached the alumni. So Madden goes up to Gibbs and says, listen, just let me know what plays you're going to run. You know, you don't have to be absolutely specific, but I kind of want to get an idea of what you're going to run. And Gibbs said, no. So Madden says, no, just, again, not specific plays. I want to know who I got to use in certain spots, so just give me an inkling of what you're thinking there. And Gibbs says, no, I'm not going to do it. You know, he's competitive, right? He doesn't want to lose at anything. So Madden says, if you don't give me those plays, I'm going to fire. I'm never going to work with you again. You're never going to work for me. We can't do it. So Madden goes on to, you know, beat Gibbs's team. And afterward, he says, you know, that's it. And Gibbs is really like, what am I going to do here? So he goes up to Coryell and says, I got a problem. I don't think I can work with John. And he explains to Coryell what happened. And Coryell thinks it over. He says, all right, you're going to be the offensive line coach, and we'll get you away from John. And John tells me, and you see, I get the credit for making Joe Gibbs an offensive coach. It was me.
And the rest is history.
The rest is history. I'm cracking up. Because yeah. Gibbs, Madden begins that thing. He says, hey, do you know the story of how I got Joe Gibbs to coach the offense? No. Oh, right. And it's like listening to a private screening of a John Madden broadcast.
Of course.
Oh, I'm coaching here. We're playing. Yeah, we're doing this. Fantastic.
Mm.
Loved it.
One of the things you say about Joe Gibbs as a coach is that this is someone who was pretty straight-laced himself, a devout Christian, and very meticulous in terms of who he himself was. And yet he managed somehow to preside over an organization that had all kinds of personalities who could not have been more different from him, including people like the legendary fullback John Riggins, quarterback Joe Theismann, and many, many other examples. He found a way to let these free spirits or, you know, kind of unconventional personalities, shall we say, be themselves within his organization, under his control. That might be, of everything he managed to accomplish, that might be one of the most impressive.
You know, that's a great point, and you're right. And Gibbs, I think, by virtue of who he was as a person, as a man, as a Christian, he was just a straight shooter, and he believed that you just tell people, be straight. You know, that's your personality. He was not flamboyant at all. I mean, he was, I guess you'd almost say, boring, in terms of, you know, he was very straight laced, but he was trustworthy, and any players knew that they could get a man who they could trust in Joe Gibbs. And I think that's what allowed him to deal with so many different personalities. And you're right, it was a different NFL back then. You know, think about this. They had what's called the 5 o'clock club, which was inherited from the Lombardi years, where the players would get together after practice, go to a shed off the practice field, and drink beer and hang out and, you know, wait for the traffic to subside. And it was a great bonding experience. And now, in today's NFL, you'd never see it. It would be deemed, you know, impermissible. There's no alcohol allowed at a team facility, no less, you know, having players go drinking in a shed after practice. But it was a good bonding thing, and Gibbs didn't particularly like that it was there, but he understood, okay, you know, they want to do that, and they have to do it. And he accepted it, and he wanted to get rid of it as time went on. So just managing those kinds of personalities, and John Riggins was famously, you know, big drinker, obviously had a drinking problem, but he somehow made it work. And just his kind of a fatherly personality enabled him, I think, to manage those personalities around him, and he understood that people were different. Doc Walker, the former tight end who played for Gibbs early on, it was what he said. Like, he would just accept people for who they were, wouldn't try to change them, and just work within the confines of their personality to get the most out of that player. Mm. And it was a brilliant way. And I don't think he tried to do it. That was just who he was. That was his natural way of being, and it lent itself to succeeding with a very diverse cast of characters.
And that's what it's all about. We are almost out of time, but I certainly don't want to finish up without giving you a chance to tell at least one story about the coach of these three that perhaps you knew the best, namely Bill Parcells of the New York Giants. After covering the Giants for so many years and knowing this organization through and through, what do you think is most important for us to remember about what made Bill Parcells great?
Yeah, I think probably that transformation after that rookie season he had as a coach in 83, when he was 3-12-1. He had picked Scott Brunner, the quarterback, over Phil Simms, prompted Simms to ask for a trade. And just the way he gathered himself, got himself together, and turned it around in 84, I think it was pretty remarkable. As good as any of those other coaches that we've talked about, any coach ever. Because and the way Bill described it to me was, he said, you know, my first year, I was trying to be who I thought I was supposed to be as a head coach. After that, I just decided I've got to be Bill Parcells. And I think if you know Parcells at all, if you've seen him, you understand what that means. You understand that he had to have his personality and had to be comfortable. And he was a hard ass. He was tough. And he said he, you know, in some ways went over the line, may have gone over the line with that 84 team and how he beat him up in training camp. He just burnt physical play into their souls, really, during training camp because he knew he had to do that. And he got rid of a bunch of players. And he turned that around. They went 9-7 that year, made the playoffs, lost to Bill Walsh in the second round of the playoffs. But Walsh even saw that this is a team to be reckoned with. And by the time it rolled around, 85-86, you know, Parcells beat Bill Walsh twice in a row. And I think my favorite story maybe of the whole book was Parcells talking to Bill Walsh. After that first victory in the 85 wildcard playoffs, they met again the next year in the NFC Championship game. And they're talking at midfield before the game, and Walsh is, you know, just chatting away. And Bill turns to Walsh, and he says, I know what you did last year, and if you do it again, I'm reporting you. I'm turning you in. And he was referring to an incident in the 85 game where Walsh, the headsets of the 49ers, went out on the first series of the game. And Parcells is describing it to me. He's laughing. He goes, somehow the 49ers headsets mysteriously went out. They just weren't working. And the rules of the NFL was if your headsets go out, the other team has to turn theirs off until they come back. And wouldn't you know it, by the time the second series came around, they were back on. But Walsh scripted his first series and first couple of series, so he tried to put Parcells at a disadvantage. And Parcells called him on it that next year. So after Parcells says, don't try to pull that crap this time, Walsh looks at him, smiles, winks, and he says, it's just a little gamesmanship. And Parcells started laughing, and Walsh started laughing. So Parcells accused Walsh of cheating, and Walsh admitted it. And Parcells was fascinated by that moment because it really transformed their relationship into one of more respect than they already had. And Walsh really did come to respect Parcells because, A, his team had lost to him, and, B, he saw that Parcells knew that he had tried to put one over on him, and he also knew that Parcells didn't tell on him, and it was just he kept it just between those two guys, and that was important to him. It was a really competitive relationship, but it was one of respect, and I found that to be fascinating. I was mesmerized when Parcells was telling that story.
Well, this book is chock full of wonderful stories of all different stripes, and I really heartily encourage people to seek out this book and to read it cover to cover as I did. It's called, again, Guts and Genius, the story of three unlikely coaches who came to dominate the NFL in the 1980s. It's published by Grand Central Publishing, and it also includes some wonderful photographs, many of which I'd never seen before. The author, Bob Glauber. Bob Glauber, I really enjoyed this, both the book and this conversation. Thank you so much for both.
Oh, thanks for having me. I really enjoyed it, too, and can't thank you enough for allowing me to talk about it. It was a fun write, and hopefully it'll be a fun read.
Support for the morning show comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2018. A unique shopping experience, time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at Jack and